needs no introduction, but Rex Bridham, professor at McGill University. I'll hand over to now. I'll also be running the final facilitation clinic. Thank you.
And it's always difficult to follow two such excellent presentations that were so rich in insight. Amongst the other thing that Robert did, I didn't realize we had to present selfies. But I'm an adaptive and agile foe, so there I am handing my drill instructor a waffle, try and beat that. What I'm talking about today, I noticed that Peter did excellent on animations, but I've got hexes for my transition, so you're going to have to up your game. What I want to talk about is the mega game we ran at Connections last year, because we were all experimenting on you. And I'm here to reveal the results of that experiment. When we designed the mega game last year, Jim Wallman and I saw a kind of opportunistic experiment that we might conduct on the back of the game. And in addition, many of you will know this if you were here last year and you were playing the game, we had three teams of generally experienced war gamers with about 130 years more experience designing or facilitating or playing war games amongst them, Team USA, Team UK, and Team Euro, which included a Brit as well. And we asked them to follow the game and write an analysis of the game after the fact. They obviously, as you know, could walk through the game, they could see what was happening, they could see all the news reporting after the fact, all the paperwork we collected in the game. Now, we weren't designing a robust experiment. It was, as these mega games tend to be, an icebreaker. We couldn't do rigorous and burdensome data collection because none of you would have come to Connections 2018 had the Connections 2017 game been like that. But it was an opportunity to test whether groups of analysts with access to identical data would reach similar conclusions about what that data showed. Jim Wallman and I joked before the game that this was our opportunity to break wargaming. And we did. There you see a Venn diagram of the findings of the three teams. The first is on methodology, the second is on substantive findings, and there's very little overlap. In other words, three teams of analysts watching the same game came to different conclusions about the game. What this may mean is that none of the stuff we've been talking about war game design, or even data collection, may make any difference at all, because you could give it to three groups of people and they could draw different conclusions about what they've just seen and what its implications are for the client. Now, I'll have a number of experimental caveats later on. I'm well aware of the limits of the experiment, but Jim and I like breaking things, and so here was an opportunity to break things. I do think we do have documented cases of very divergent interpretations of the same game. And perhaps the biggest one in sort of wargaming history and legend is Millennium Challenge 2002. The critique of that, of course, is it's a game that showed that everything was broken about American wargaming, that red wasn't allowed to win, that the blue fleet was sunk and it was refloated, and it was systematically broken. The official DoD report doesn't say that at all, and the defenders of the game pointed out that the reason the blue fleet was sunk was because it was wrongly placed on the map. It had to have the close in weapon systems and defensive systems all turned off because they were misbehaving in the computer construct. Someone was away from their station during coffee, etc. There were a whole series of reasons that things that Red did shouldn't have been allowed to happen because they were impossible and it was an artificial aspect of the game that produced us. We have two completely different discourses on what three, because the DoD report is somewhere different again, on the same game. It is, of course, the critique that is the one that's become most famous. Miku Zenko has it in a book in which it's an entire chapter on red teaming, and I, in fact, think he draws some wrong conclusions about the weakness of the red teaming there because he's bought into one particular narrative of what happened in Millennium Challenge 2002. So as I say, the implications of what we did in this little experiment are that there are particular, someone said earlier in response to something Peter was saying, he said, what do we need for good analysis? The correct answer was good data, but the shouted answer was good analysts, and actually that feeds in very nicely to what I'm having to say today. because I think there are largely unexplored challenges in game analysis. And I'm going to focus on some of the cognitive challenges, because amongst the things I do is I've worked on the intelligence community on assessment of predictive accuracy. In Canada, did a very large project of reviewing all of our intelligence assessment for about a decade to see if it was right or wrong, putting that into an unclassified database in which the actual judgment is scrubbed out so you can't tell, and then looking at were experienced analysts better than other analysts, were interdepartmental analyses better than those who were done in a single shot, and so on and so forth. And that led to an interest in the literature on prediction, forecasting, and cognition, much of which is what you're going to hear from me today. So let me talk a little bit more about the experimental approach that we used and its limits. And since we've been talking about methodology, I want to underscore that we had to go with the game we had, and there were limits to our ability to experiment. On those of you who were there last year, it was dire straits. Like the mega game this year, was primarily served as an icebreaker for the conference and a kind of welcoming to wargaming function on the first day of Connections. About 100 participants, give or take, with limited subject matter expertise. The Dire Straits game was about multiple near-future simultaneous geopolitical crises in Asia. So we had a North Korea nuclear crisis, we had the sort of ongoing South China Sea problems, we had a Doklam Plateau issue going on with regard to India and China, and we had a Chinese hacking of a Taiwanese election, which led to the election of a much more independently minded Taiwanese government and corresponding Chinese anger in the context of the Trump administration. So partly it was looking at whether changes in US policy and the growing power of China would affect crisis dynamics in East Asia, and also it seemed like a cool topic to do, which is how Jim and I tend to choose topics as well. As you will know from having taken part in the mega game today, they are large, they are noisy, they're chaotic, they're loose, they're hard to document. Even if you can walk around the mega game, you're only capturing a tiny part of it at any one time. And we didn't have 100 rapporteurs following everyone around to find out what they were doing. So there were inevitably some experimental bugs. As I say, the game methodology was not up to the standards of an official analytical game. However, that was actually valuable from an experimental point of view, because we could see whether our three teams identified the same problems or not. So the fact that there were problems in the game design was, from the experiment point of view, a bit of an asset as well as a bit of a disadvantage. Another aspect that was interesting, and I'll leverage it in a minute, is that it's fair to say that US foreign policy behavior in the Trump era is a sometimes controversial or even polarizing issue, more so in the United States than in Europe, where there tends to be more consensus on US foreign policy behavior in the Trump era. And so that was a key part of the game as well. I'm going to talk about that in a minute. We had an opportunistic group of analysts too. It was essentially people who were willing to volunteer to be analysts. If I was running this as a formal experiment, I might pre-screen for political views or personality types or experience or service record or other kinds of things, but we had who we did. However, I do think there was probably, and not all of the US team had identical political views, or all of the British team, or all of the European team. It is fair to say that US foreign policy behavior is, as I say, controversial in the United States, and less controversial in the rest of the world, where if you'll see this data here on differentials between approval ratings, pluses and minuses, they're typically down in the minus 50 to minus 70 range, in Canada and the Western Europe, whereas it's in the minus 11 range in the United States. So that was one, and you'll see when I get on to talking about cognitive bias, that's one possible thing that might have spread out some of the interpretations of findings. And as you saw with those previous Venn diagrams, and I've got a more detailed version of that later, there was very significant variation in how the analyst teams interpreted the game. So why might we get this? Well, one challenge for all analysis, but it includes war game analysis, is confirmation bias. That is to say, the tendency to search for, interpret, favor, or recall information in a way that confirms to your pre-existing beliefs or hypotheses. Those, as I say, could be political views, they could be organizational views, they could be views about doctrine or weapon systems or procurement or bureaucratic process or anything else. Confirmation bias also means that we tend to have a preference for early information, and once we've made up our minds, it is increasingly difficult for us to update as proper Bayesians, that is to say, when we get new and particularly different information, change our minds. There is no reason, we always think about our players doing this, but there's no reason, in fact, it is a certainty that our analysts do this too. It's one of the reasons, and Volko could talk about it far more than me, that analyst training in the intelligence community is less in many ways about formal methodologies and more about controlling for analyst biases. So that's to say, the biases we bring ourselves as analysts unknown into the process. If you have strong views on particular things, you have motivated beliefs, the evidence from cognitive science and psychology is also particularly difficult to change. And you may, in fact, rearrange the rest of your belief system to keep certain things intact that you're firmly attached to. So one of the challenges we have to think about is confirmation bias on the part of our analysts. I gave an almost identical version of this presentation at Connections US. And when I gave it, Ed McGrady said, yes, well, I mean, I think I know when I assign this analyst to do an analysis, they're going to come to this conclusion. But think how problematic that statement is, that you know what they'll find before they've looked at the data because you know who the analyst is and what kinds of things they want to find. That's a deeply problematic observation. Second thing, and those of you who were at Connections a year or two ago where I talked about this, that I think is important is framing effects. There is a great deal of evidence that how players play a game depends on how the game looks. I don't just mean looks physically, but what they think is it about. And this is one of my favorite findings from experimental psychology. This was a simple game theoretic experiment in which players were asked to play Prisoner's Dilemma, and they played it completely different depending on what the game was called. Nothing was changed in payoff structure. Nothing was changed in presentation. They changed three or four words. If it was called the Wall Street game, they tended to defect. If it was called the community development game, they tended to cooperate. The ratio was 2-1, and it flipped when you just changed the name of the game. Okay, so the way, yes, so your game behavior may have as much to do with the way, what the players think the game is about as the actual game mechanics and so on and so forth. So, this is a really fascinating finding, and it means we need to think about how our game presentation scenario, what we say the research objectives are, the graphics, the fluff, the context, the briefing documents, and so forth, will affect player behavior. Now, in the Dire Straits game, there was a U.S. subgame. We had no Donald Trump. We had a Donald Trump game in which senior U.S. officials were trying to influence Donald Trump's policy positions. And they had various resources to try and convince him to do that. And we had bureaucratic process where the chief of staff could try and act as a gatekeeper and so on and so forth. And we had incentives because you could get fired if the president had lost confidence in you. Essentially, the game was this. There were a series of potential U.S. policy positions, a bunch of players with different interests, different political views, different policy views, different bureaucratic interests. They had resources that affected the president's view, and at some point, a policy position would emerge. Now, that game, I was able to take the Donald Trump pronouncements out of the board game and match them against actual Donald Trump tweets in the 2 months after we played Dire Straits here, and they were very close. It was about an 85% convergence rating, which is not bad in terms of predicting what a government will do in the next 2 month period. The problem, and here I will admit to a mistake, which has to do with my sense of humor, is that the Donald Trump subgame didn't look like that. Had to be a very boring policy track. I wouldn't have run into this problem. The Donald Trump subgame looked like this. Okay, Donald Trump was a giant head, and you had to get tweets up to the top of it. And you had cards which all had pop art on them. There was significant difference amongst the three analytical teams about the US subgame. The US team thought it was just completely broken. The British team, and I'm paraphrasing here, thought it should be much more respectful, but didn't have big problems with its effect on the overall gameplay. And Team Euro thought it was just about right. I think they said, is rather cartoonish but seems accurate, which you can read in a number of ways. Now, I will admit that I shouldn't have done that, but it may have accidentally revealed something about about how analysts may perceive game outputs by the way the game looks, not necessarily what's going on in the game. Groups. Now, I'm gonna talk a bit here about how we might deal with this in terms of organizing our analytical effort around games. And here we have a bit of a tension. It's a bit of an argument between myself and Stephen Downs Martin. We've talked about the wisdom of crowds. Volko talked about the value of the wisdom of crowds. There's evidence of the wisdom of crowds that you aggregate a bunch of separate views and they come to a superior estimate than individuals tend to. So there's a lot of evidence that group assessment, particularly by diverse groups, which is something Volko said too, produces better analytical performance. But at the same time, we also know that there can be problems with groupthink, there can be problems with hierarchy, there can be problems with juniors not feeling empowered to express their views because of seniors in the room and so forth. So we really have to think about how we improve analytical performance without falling into traps of groupthink or hierarchy or unwillingness to articulate views. And I think there's a lot of experimental evidence, particularly from the literature on political and other forecasting, that your aggregation and team design methods matter. You not only want diverse teams, which again is something that Volko underpinned and is in a lot of the academic work I've done as well, but you also want to find a mechanism for registering first impressions before they're too molded by groupthink or hierarchy, and so on and so forth. You also tend to want, there's an interesting literature on political forecasting by Phil Tetlock, which found that on politics, which is where I have a PhD, human beings are no better than dart-throwing monkeys at predicting political outcomes, and sadly, having a political science PhD doesn't help at all. But what does matter is cognitive style, that those who are cognitive foxes and know a little about a lot of subjects and are not wedded to a particular paradigm massively outperform hedgehogs who know a great deal about something but are very wedded to a particular view of the world, which can be, I say speaking as an SME, a problem with SMEs, because SMEs, we can get very attached to the way we see the world, what we've written, what we've said, the way we've made our careers and so forth. This, by the way, is the, like if anyone wants it, it'll be on the slides when they're shared. I mean, these are the main five findings on methodology and substantive analysis from the teams. The green is where they all agreed, the yellow is where two of the teams agreed, and the red is where a team raised a point that the other team hadn't raised at all. Now, usually I speak too long, but I'm going to end it on this point, because it's only a very simple point, but I do think it would do, it would, actually I'm going to make 2 points when it's not on the slide. I do think it would be very useful to red team our analysis. We red team in the game, but I think it would be very useful to have two teams doing the analysis, have them anchor their analytical findings, so Chinese wall them, so they're not talking to each other and trying to come to a consensus, have them pin down their initial impressions of what the game said, and then try to synthesize those two. I think if your two teams separately come to identical conclusions, you can have a greater level of confidence in the robustness of the game. And if two teams watching the same game with access to the same data come to different conclusions about what the game showed, not only do you have to think about how you're going to synthesize that, but that could be a problem with game design. It could be one of the teams identified something that the other wasn't evident to the other team, which might have been lost in hierarchy or seniority or groupthink or what have you. It's an issue to be explored, which might actually be quite valuable, but you won't otherwise know it if there's a single report produced by consensus. So I do think we need to have our analysts do their first impressions before they start working collectively. The other thing I will say, and it came up in some earlier discussion, which is why it's not on a slide, and I made this point in other contexts before, is as a general rule, we never go back to games 3 or 5 or 10 years later to see if they were right or wrong or why not. John Curry raised this in going back to some games and saying how accurately they model modern warfare. I've done it in the intelligence community where we systematically looked at every single judgment, every single sentence that appeared to predict the future and judged it as right, mainly right, mainly wrong, completely wrong in the context of the discussion or what have you. But why do we not do that with war games? What we do with war games is we produce them, we give them to the client, they go on a shelf somewhere. Sometimes it's even hard to find all the parts of it, 5 years later because people have moved on and they're not sure where all the records are. We should systematically, as a refinement, as an improvement in our craft, take old games, look at them, find out whether they were right, whether they were wrong, whether they flagged issues that didn't appear in the report to the extent that we have that data, why they were right, why they were wrong, and maybe even whether the findings were appropriately actioned or just lost, and in that improve our craft. And there's certainly evidence in the intelligence community that tracking predictive accuracy improves predictive accuracy. And the Good Judgment Program, which was a project which was originally a IARPA-funded project on political forecasting, which scored teams and, you know, identified super forecasters and have used a system of metrics for how right people had been, has produced quite impressive results in improving collective performance through measuring past performance and allowing people to learn from their mistakes. So those are the points I wanted to make. Whether we've broken wargaming or not, we can leave to the discussion.